Good evening and welcome to tonight's Gnostic Wave Show, the program that delivers to your receiver all things of a Gnostic nature, and particularly through the four pillars, science, art, philosophy and mysticism. Now, tonight we're joined by a special guest, Christian Keefe, who's a Gnostic instructor from Newcastle, New South Wales. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Diana. How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. And thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for the invite. Is it second or third invite? I think it's the third invite, so
yes,
yeah, I appreciate that.
So our listeners may have heard the review of The Matrix that Christian did last year in over two parts, and now for the highly anticipated review of the sequel to The Matrix, we have him back for Matrix Reloaded.
Thank you. So it was actually very interesting. As Gnostics, we have retreats and meditation retreats and things like that. And in a retreat in Perth, I saw someone from America, from the United States, and he had listened to the radio show through the podcast, through the website, and he thanked me for the for what we talked about. So it's interesting that you can give this radio show and it can go to the whole of the world, so to speak, and you can influence someone in that way. So I'd just like to say a big hello to John from Missoula, who I met at the retreat, who thanked me. I think it was on the first day as well, so it made my retreat that little bit more special. And he also talked about his mother, and I can't exactly remember her name. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was Sue, and she lived in Minneapolis, who also enjoyed the radio show. So I just wanted to say a big hello out to the Gnostics and those two in particular.
Yes, we appreciate and all the listeners and the feedback that they provide for the show.
Definitely.
All right. Well, I leave the audience in your capable hands.
Thank you, Diana. So to start off, I just wanted to give a recap from The Matrix, just a basic recap, especially of the characters. So we'll go through the characters and then we'll go through the basic themes of the film, especially relating to esotericism and Gnosticism, and then a breakdown of the film itself. So we sort of run with the film like we did last time and have sound bites and explain the film gnostically. So the basic recap to remember is that we talked about the archetypes and the characters and the film itself. And the film itself is based on, or an archetype, we could say, of the path. And the first film is about that aspect of awakening, the first aspect. And then this film, we could say, is a little bit more further on in the path. And I've reflected that the nature of the awakening is something that's very close to us, that we really relate to a type of awakening, even if it's not a spiritual awakening, but even an intellectual awakening, or seeing a different view, a different perspective, something of a higher nature, especially esoterically, we really understand that type of awakening. And so this film, we start to move a little bit more deeper into that awakening and into the path. Also, we have Neo, who symbolizes choice and free will, which is one of the main aspects of the path, that we have to continually make choices, and choices of a higher vibration, we could say, to continue on the path. So he represents choice and free will. We have Trinity, who symbolizes and represents, we could say, love. Morpheus, who symbolizes faith and belief and trust. And then lastly, we have Agent Smith, who symbolizes the ego. So this is all the vices and all the psychological issues that we have within us that impede us on the path, impede our happiness, our knowledge. So we pretty much know those four characters, and you can always go back to the old podcast on Gnostic Waves and listen to The Matrix. So, but that's just the basic understanding. And by the end of The Matrix of the film, three main characters have sort of fulfilled a mission in some way or a purpose, a type of purpose. So Morpheus has found the one. Trinity has fallen in love with the One, and vice versa. Neo has fallen in love with Trinity. And we find that Neo is the One, and he is now awakened and has considerable powers now, considerable faculties. So he has clairvoyance and intuition. He can fly. He flies at the end of the Matrix, showing that type of power and healing. So he has a fair amount of power now. And Agent Smith appears to be dead. So that's the end of the Matrix. And it's interesting because those missions from those characters were told by the Oracle, who's another character, who's the main female divine mother archetype, who points these characters or archetypes in the right direction. And they fulfilled all those missions, so to speak, in the first film. So we just need to run over some new characters in the film, which are very interesting. So we have, in a small role, Councilman Harmon. Neo will have a chat with him, and I really like the conversation that he has with him, because Councilman Harmon talks about, which I'll go into, the good and the bad and the bad and the good. And we also have a new term that I'd like to sort of describe for everyone called the Archons. So there are two characters who represent the Archons, we could say. The Merovingian and the Architect represent Archons. So the Archons are rulers of different Sephiroths. So Sephiroth is a term from Kabbalah. The Kabbalah is the tree of life, and we could say the Sephiroths, or the Sephirah, are the branches. And what they really are, we could say, is different dimensions. So there are different gods or entities or masters or angels, however we'd like to say, that are assigned a particular dimension. And Archons in Greek, it means ruler or king. So they are ruler of a particular sphere or dimension. And so these Archons, which we have talked about, and they're mainly talked about very strongly in a book called Pistosophia, which is a strong Gnostic book. So they're rulers of their own particular sphere, and only their sphere. So they don't really know the dimension above them or the dimension below them. However, they're pretty much king of their own dimension. And in this film, Neo goes up against two of them, as we said, the Merovingian, who relates to cause and effect and karma, which is a strong eternal value that we have to come and recognize on the path, and the Architect, which relates to the Demiurge, which is a part of the Pistosphere, and the ruler of the cosmos itself. So he's the creator. And so, as we said, they are very strong in their own dimension. They understand their dimension, but they don't really know anything above or below it. So in this way, both of these characters are seen to be very pompous and arrogant and really believe themselves to be very powerful, but they don't really understand that there's power above them. So that's one of their, you could say, fatal flaws. And so they're powerful in their own sphere, and they only know their own sphere or dimension. And they don't really know anything beyond that sphere, as we said. But they believe themselves to be all-knowing. So that's the issue with these guys. And Neo has to, we could say, fight these or overcome these, like a test or a trial. And these two are two very strong aspects on the part we need to overcome. So the Merovingian is played by a French actor called, I'm not quite sure how to say his name. It's Lambert Wilson, but I assume he's French. I think the name would be Lambert Wilson. And the Merovingian, the name of the Merovingian, comes from a family of kings in France that supposedly have the bloodline of the Christ, of Jesus Christ. So we seem like that he might be related somehow to the One or to some aspect. And he's married to Persephone, who's played by the very stunning Monica Bellucci. And in Greek mythology, Persephone was the queen of the underworld, so the queen of the abyss or the queen of hell. And so in this film, they're married, and we'll go into it, but the Merovingian doesn't represent an aspect called the law, but he knows very strongly of the laws. And it's hinted at that it is possible that the Merovingian himself was the one in a previous incarnation, but he failed and became what is known as a fallen bodhisattva. I'm not going to go through the conversation, but Persephone says to Neo, you know, he used to be like you. And so it's like the Merovingian tried to do what Neo was doing, but didn't quite get there and was lost. And so the Merovingian has this character called the Keymaker. So the Keymaker is a program that knows how to navigate the many areas of the Matrix. And in the film, he does this by using keys and back doors. So these keys and back doors are similar to these dimensions and these Sephiroths that we're talking about. He's able to access areas that other people can't because he makes keys. And so he can make any key to go into any door and go anywhere. And so the Merovingian, as we'll go into it, relates to cause and effect, which we'll explain as we go through the film. And when we go beyond cause and effect, it means that we can create our own circumstances. So the Keymaker represents a power, we could say, called epigenesis, which means that we're not, the circumstances of life are not burdening us, but we sort of start to go beyond them. So we'll try and explain that one a little bit more deeper as we go into it. And then lastly, we have the Architect, which is the creator of the Matrix. He's a symbol of what's known as the Demiurge Architect, known in the Pista Sophia, that book that I've talked about, and the Freemasons talk about the Demiurge Architect. And so he's also known as the Elohim. And once again, he's the creator of the Matrix, but he doesn't understand that there's a superior creator above him, which is very, very, very interesting. So they're the new main characters, most of them that Neo will have to fight, and he still has to fight the Matrix itself and the agents and all those sorts of things. So the main themes that I'd like to introduce, which The Matrix Reloaded goes a little bit more deeper into, is the nature of the couple. We could say that the Matrix has three couples that represent different aspects of love. So first off, we have Neo and Trinity, which represents a true love, we could say, an unconditioned love, a spiritual love, using the love between them for higher states of consciousness, we could say, known as the tantric couple and also known as supersexuality. The second couple is a character called Link and his wife Z, and they're more of a normal couple. So your normal sexual couple, normal love, but, you know, love with problems. So they live a life and they have issues and problems of the normal life, and they will deem them, it's said to be, as normal sexuality. And then the third couple in the film, as we've stated before, is the Merovingian and Persephone. This is the couple together, but separate. There's no love in this couple anymore. The love is lost. And they seek love elsewhere, and they talk about sampling love and sampling things. So this is called infrasexuality. So in the first film, Morpheus guides Neo, but Neo must save Morpheus. So in the Matrix, Neo saves Morpheus from the agents. However, in this film, Neo must save Trinity. So it goes from Morpheus to Trinity. So Neo's relationship with Morpheus is not as strong anymore, and Neo's relationship with Trinity starts to become stronger, and it's the ultimate test of love between them as we go into it. So that's just the nature of the couple. So it's something very interesting to watch when we watch the film next time. There's also an element of materialism versus spiritualism or esotericism, which are a very strong aspect in the film. So there are two major understandings in order to save Zion? Because one of the main issues of the film is how are we going to save Zion? How are we going to save humanity? And so there are two characters who have power in the film who are going about it their own way. So we have Morpheus, who is the spiritual Gnostic, the esoteric guy, who believes Zion will be saved through the One, through Neo. And then in contradiction to that, we have Commander Locke, who represents the physical or material or skeptical life, and he believes that Zion will be saved purely through force, through war, through battling the machines. And so it sets up that ideal throughout the film. And so the nature of the path is to work on the consciousness. You cannot work on the consciousness of another. So we might have explained that in the other podcasts. There is no doubt that we can help and guide and sacrifice for humanity and help other people, but the actual work alone has to be done by the person, by the consciousness. And it's specifically in the consciousness where we will gain knowledge, in our own consciousness, because we only have our own. In the film, we find that later on in the film, Neo is given a grave choice to save his love, Trinity, or to save Zion and pretty much all of humanity. And so we'll find out what happens in that. I won't spoil it right now. So the last main theme of this film is purpose or meaning in one's life. So now it's not about the choice, but why you made the choice. So that's what the Oracle says. So the first film is very strongly based on choice, that Neo has to continually make choice after choice, and then eventually that choice will raise his level of being and he'll understand and go higher and his consciousness will awaken. However, in this film, it's more interested in understanding why we start to make these choices. So The Matrix is about free will and making the right choice, the first film. The second film, The Matrix Reloaded, is interested in the reason behind making the right choice. So The Matrix, we could say, if we're going to go into strict Gnostic terminology, The Matrix is about the essence and the virtues of us, and then The Matrix Reloaded is about the consciousness at a deeper level of the awakening. So purpose relates to the meaning of life itself. Do we have a purpose in life? You know, what is the meaning of life? I'm sure you've asked that question to yourself. What's the meaning of my life? You know, is it my day-to-day struggles that I have, my job, my family, all these things? Or is the meaning of life something greater? And so that's what this film looks into, trying to understand the purpose behind everything, the meaning behind everything. So we'll dive into that as well. Okay, so let's start the scene breakdown of the film, running through the film and getting an understanding of how the Wachowski brothers relate the awakening and the path through the film. We do so in really a beautiful way and quite an ingenious fashion. And as we said in the last podcast, that they do it in such a popular way, like it's such an easily consumable, you know, fun, beautiful film. But underlying the themes and the archetypes and the meaning of the film really strike home to the consciousness. Even if we don't realize it at the time, we watch the film and I really like that film and I enjoy the explosions and the action and characters are cool and... But there's something else that's, you know, eating at me that I'm like, wow, that's really cool. It's just the thoughts and the underlying philosophy. So let's dig into it. So it said that The Matrix Reloaded takes 6 months after the film of The Matrix. So we're 6 months further down the track. And the film starts where we are following Trinity, and she seems to be on some type of mission. And so she rides her motorcycle into a guard station and she fights all the guards and they're all killed. And it's a very interesting and big opening scene because the bike is flung in the air and she jumps off and the motorcycle goes into this guard station, and the explosion that comes from that is just insane, really. Like, it's just so over the top and so huge. And she hits the ground and then beats up the guys, the security guards. And then she, in the next scene, we see Trinity falling off a building, which must, we think, relates to something to do with the mission that she's got. And she's been pursued by a new agent. And I really like the scene because she's falling out, and then the agent just jumps out of the building as well. And he doesn't really care for his death. He just cares for the death of Trinity, which is the mechanical nature of those agents. And so as they're falling off the building, Trinity and this agent are both shooting at each other. And we see this all in slow motion, and we see the bullets being shot out of the guns in slow motion. And on the way down, Trinity is eventually hit, and she dies, and then she falls into a car, and it all sort of smashes up, and she dies. So, interesting start. And then the next thing, Neo wakes up, and we realize that it's just all been a dream. And we're left to wonder, is it a dream, or is it something more? Is it a prophetic dream? You know, what's going on? And so we realize that now they're both on the Nebuchadnezzar, which is the ship piloted by Morpheus. And then as they're driving around or flying around in the ship, Morpheus, and there's a new character, Link, which we talked about before, they have a conversation, and it relates to the nature of Morpheus.
Link.
Yes, sir.
Given your situation, I can't say I fully understand your reasons for volunteering to operate on board my ship. However, if you wish to continue to do so, I must ask you to do one thing.
What's that, sir?
To trust me.
Yes, sir. I will, sir. I mean, I do, sir.
So we see that once again, coming from the original Matrix film, that Morpheus is very strongly about belief and about trust. And I'd just like to say, a wise man once told me, trust is the antidote of fear. So I really like that. So I just wanted to put that in there. So further on, inside the ship, we find Neo and Trinity aboard the Nebuchadnezzar, and Trinity is trying to comfort Neo.
They're just dreams.
If you're afraid of something.
I just wish. I wish I knew what I'm supposed to do. That's all. I just wish I knew.
She's gonna call. Don't worry.
So we can see there is an element of fear there as opposed to trust, that Neo at the moment is a little bit lost. He doesn't know what to do. And he wants some guidance. And interestingly, Morpheus cannot give this guidance anymore. He needs a higher guidance, a specific guidance from the Oracle, who symbolizes the Divine Mother. So we see that at this point in time that Neo doesn't really have a purpose anymore. And as we said, this is one of the main themes of Matrix Reloaded. As we said, the nature of our lives, the purpose of our lives, and without purpose, you have no meaning in your life. So it's something interesting to reflect upon within ourselves. What's the meaning of life, as we've said? So some news comes through. And in the Matrix, all the captains of all the ships gather together to listen to this new piece of news. And so from one of the other ships, there's a transmission from the Osiris. So the Osiris is the Egyptian god that actually relates to the Sephiroth Keter. And Osiris is one of the parts of the Trinity, with Osiris, Isis, and Horus. So they find out that the machines are drilling a hole down to Zion, which is going to be absolutely catastrophic for the humans. They thought that they had more of a chance if they hold up, but at the moment, it's only a matter of time before the machines gain access to Zion, and then there's going to be a war, pretty much. They're going to have to defend themselves in there. So as we said, this starts the process of how the film is going to show the two different ways that we can go about things. In a physical way, beating the machines, beating these machines, or lastly, through faith and through Neo. And it said that the war is going to end one way or the other. So the plot has been beefed up at the moment. The plot is thickening, so to speak. So the captains continue to talk, and they're trying to work out what to do, and Neo senses something, and he heads off to go and check it out, and Morpheus asks the captains to disobey a direct order from Commander Locke and asks that one of the ships stays behind. And the reason for that is he would stay behind, but his ship doesn't have enough energy or enough fuel. And so he asks if someone else, just one ship, can stay behind just in case the Oracle sends a message for Neo to contact.
But we well know that the reason most of us are here is because of our affinity for disobedience.
So the Gnostic, the person walking the path, needs a type of rebellious nature to them. One has to rebel against the nature of who they are, so to speak. Gnostics take things for granted, that things are the way that they are meant to be and always will be. The Gnostic questions everything in order to investigate and find the truth. So we could say that the rebellion that we can have can be a physical rebellion, or in Gnostic terms, a psychological and esoteric rebellion. And that's a rebellion that is internal, while the physical rebellion is something external. So the captains are talking in the back room, so to speak, and Agent Smith arrives at the door, and he says this.
I'm looking for Neo.
Never heard of him.
I have something for him. A gift. You see, he set me free.
Fine, whatever. Now piss off.
So Neo raises the alarm and everyone leaves because there's agents about. And he fights the three agents. And these are new agents. These are agents we've never seen before. And interestingly, he beats them up pretty much. And then he flies off. So this is an interesting terms of events because there's an aspect where he sort of understands now that he can't beat them physically. And he can, you know, have a fight, but then he's going to have to fly off. There's no other recourse. And Agent Smith himself comes, and we find out now that there's two Agent Smiths. So at the start of The Matrix Reloaded, we assumed that he may have been dead, but it's actually much worse. Agent Smith is starting to grow and clone and duplicate himself. And this is very similar to the nature of the ego itself, which is known to be a multiplicity. And in the Bible, the ego is talked about as being a legion. So this reminds us of seeing the ego in more and more depths. And when we begin to self-observe and look internally, we see more and more egos, or we see more and more Agent Smiths. So the ego is a multiplicity. So all the different psychological defects that we have, when we look into it, when we find them, they're many. We don't just have one issue. So we have anger, and then we have lots of different types of anger and types of frustrations, and then lots of different prides and lots of different lusts and greeds and gluttonies. And so if we start to look into ourselves, we find that the ego is, there's a lot of different types and fears, skepticisms, there's so many. And so the ego is really a multiplicity where we've always thought of ourselves as a singularity, that I'm Christian and it's just me. When we start to look internally, we really see that there's a whole heap of other things inside that are manipulating us. So when Agent Smith comes and we see Neo has already flown off and he drops in to see the Oracle, and we find out that she's not living there anymore and she's supposedly on the run, or she's sought refuge elsewhere. So the captains are out of the Matrix, everyone's out of the Matrix, and everyone's now back in Zion except for that one ship, the Caduceus, which is helmed by, I think it's Roy Jones Jr., who was a famous boxer at the time. He's pretty cool in the film, just the way that he talks, and I really liked his small cameo. And so when the Nebuchadnezzar arrives, Morpheus is detained by Commander Locke. And as we say, Commander Locke represents that more physical understanding of how to beat the machines. And they have a chat about the problems that they have between them. And we see that Morpheus talks from, as we said, that more aspect of spirituality and faith, while Commander Locke is that more material, skeptical person.
I would have stayed, but I needed to recharge my ship.
So you admit to a direct contravention of your duty?
Commander, we need a presence inside the Matrix to await contact from the Oracle.
I don't want
to
hear that shit. I don't care about oracles or prophecies or messiahs. I care about one thing: stopping that army from destroying this city. And to do that, I need soldiers to obey my orders.
With all due respect, Commander, there is only one way to save our city.
How?
Neo.
God damn it, Morpheus. Not everyone believes what you believe.
My beliefs do not require them to.
So in the conversation, we now see the strong difference between the two men. So Morpheus has belief in Neo, while Commander Locke has no belief or no faith whatsoever in Neo, and so he has to resort to that physical violence. So we now definitely see the two aspects, or the two ways that we're going to save Zion. And so, as we said, there's a character called Councilman Harmon, and he comes into the room as they're sort of discussing all these issues between the two men. And he says that there's a gathering tonight, and that there are growing rumors in Zion about the machines and what's happening. And he asks them, you know, what should we do? What should we talk about at the gathering?
The presence of the fleet and the persistence of rumors must be addressed. The people must be told what is happening.
Of course, Counselor. But might I advise a level of discretion concerning specific details? We do not wish to start a panic.
Quite right. But panic is not what anyone wants. What about you, Captain? What would you advise?
The truth. No one will panic. Because there is nothing to fear. That army will never reach the gates of Zion.
So it continues on from their different perspectives. It shows an even bigger difference between the two men. So we have Commander Locke, who is fearful of what will happen, and he doesn't want to start a panic because of fear. And so that skeptical, materialistic, physical way, an element of fear. While Morpheus wants everyone to know and to not be ignorant because he's only interested in one thing, the truth, and that they really have nothing to fear. So that element of faith that Morpheus has means that he doesn't have that fear, while Commander Locke is very fearful of what's going to happen. So we see that big difference between the two men and how they're going about things. And it's an interesting thing. When you have the truth, you don't have fear anymore. So we really understand the character of Morpheus more from that conversation, that his decisiveness, which we love about that character, is really based on his lack of fear and his faith. And it's interesting because he was given that knowledge through the Oracle. The Oracle said, you know, you're going to find the one. And so he's very strong with that. He's very strong in his faith and his belief. So in the end, Harmon chooses Morpheus overlook to talk at the gathering. So Neo and Morpheus are now about to go home, and they're stopped by many people who see Neo now almost as a Christ-like figure. And they all want something from him, or to be touched, or, you know, something, some words. However, it's interesting because Neo is more interested in Trinity.
No way.
It's all right. They need you.
I need you.
I know. There's time.
So we can see that the bond between Neo and Trinity is very strong, and that Neo needs Trinity just as much as Trinity needs Neo. So there's a really strong love, a strong connection, a spiritual connection between the couple. That there's a need. And she also allows him to go about and, you know, attend to the people. And she knows that she has time. So she's still loving in that way where they have that strong bond, but he's allowed to do other things. Also coming home is Link to his wife, Z. And in that scene, we see Link and Z fighting over his role in the Nebuchadnezzar. So where Link is more interested in being intimate with Z, Z is pretty unhappy. And so that they're sort of fighting a bit. And here we see the normal couple, so to speak, you know, the normal physical couple. So we get that contrast between Neo and Trinity and Link and Z. And so on the next scene, it's the night. The night of the gathering, and Morpheus speaks. First, Cancel Harmon has a speech, and then Morpheus comes. And he speaks of what's really happening, the fearlessness that he has to remove fear of the situation. And this is what he says.
It is true what many of you have heard. The machines have gathered an army, and as I speak, that army is drawing nearer to our home. Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here before you now, truthfully, unafraid. Why? Because I believe something you do not? No. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. I remember that for 100 years they have sent their armies to destroy us. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here!
And then lastly, he ends his speech with the following.
This is Zion, and we are not afraid!
So there's a famous quote about fear from Roosevelt, and he said, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. And so what Morpheus is talking about is essentially that we need to remove the nature of fear within us, something that Commander Locke cannot do, something that he does very easily with his faith. And so it's one of those rousing movie speeches where he's getting everyone up for the upcoming sort of war. And the crowd is whipped into an absolute frenzy. Zion is going off. And then there's a party that begins that some people have said looks a bit like a rave, because there's a lot of dancing and people are jumping up and down and throwing people up in the air. And it's interesting because this scene has quite a sexual feeling to it, the way that everyone's partying and dancing. It's almost like an animalistic, the way that they do it. And we see the couple, Link and Z, are dancing in that way, in that very sexual way. And so everyone in Zion is pretty much dancing there. And then we contrast that to the intimate nature that Neo and Trinity are together, we could say, doing the tantra. So we definitely see that contrast, the intimate connection of love between Neo and Trinity, and then the rest of Zion who are all dancing together. And so we see that Neo and Trinity are doing something different, you know, a different type of love, we could say, something higher, something more esoteric. So at the same time, inside the Matrix, we find that Agent Smith is multiplying himself. He's cloning himself, duplicating himself. And now there are many Agent Smiths. So one was bad enough. Now there's many. And it gets worse. Agent Smith actually goes into Bane, who's a member of Zion. And as Bane is jacking back out of the Matrix, Agent Smith somehow follows him and takes on his body. So now Agent Smith is in the Matrix and he's multiplying himself and he's actually in reality in Zion now as Bane. And I remember when I watched this for the first time, it was a big turn up in the books and something that I was like, wow, what's going on? Is that even possible? And it really shows the dualistic nature of Neo and Agent Smith. That Agent Smith as the ego can only really multiply himself and he can't do much else. So Agent Smith can't sort of change his quality so much. He can't really go higher, but he can increase his numbers. While Neo is someone who's getting higher, a higher vibration, higher states of consciousness, and he doesn't really need to duplicate himself. He doesn't really need that type of power. So the plot is thickening even more. In the next scene, we see Neo and Councilman Harmon, and both of them can't sleep. They're both awake. And they have a very, very interesting conversation together.
Almost no one comes down here, unless, of course, there's a problem. That's how it is with people. Nobody cares how it works as long as it works. I like it down here. I like to be reminded this city survives because of these machines. These machines are keeping us alive while other machines are coming to kill us. Interesting, isn't it? Power to give life and the power to end it. We have the same power. Yeah, I suppose we do, but down here sometimes I think about all those people still plugged into the Matrix, and when I look at these machines, I can't help thinking that in a way we are plugged into them.
But we control these machines. They don't control us.
Well, of course not. How could they? The idea is pure nonsense, but it does make one wonder just what is control?
If we wanted, we could shut these machines down.
Of course. That's it. You hit it. That's control, isn't it? If we wanted, we could smash them to bits. Although if we did, we'd have to consider what would happen to our lights, our heat, our air.
So we need machines and they need us. Is that your point, Counselor?
So I really love that scene with those two. It sort of comes a bit out of nowhere. And Councilman Harmon talks in such an enlightened way. He sees, as we said, the good in the bad and the bad in the good. So that's one of the aspects of the awakening, because usually we only see one point of view. We either see something as good or something as bad. But an awakened person sees the good and bad in everything, the fullness in everything. And so he sees this situation with the machines. And he's telling Neo that the machines aren't inherently good or bad, because from the perspective of the people of Zion, machines are bad. You know, machines are going to kill them. Machines enslave them. And he's right. However, there are some machines that they use for good, you know, that help them with the air and the heat and living. So some machines are good and some are bad. It just depends on one thing, their purpose. So this is a profound point. And he also brings up another issue, which is related to purpose and all the themes that we talk about in The Matrix, and that's control and interdependence. The Buddhists talk very strongly about interdependence, that nothing in this world is independent of anything else, and that it is very silly to say that we're completely independent, that we don't need anyone else or anything. And by the very nature of the cosmos, we are dependent on many things. And Councilman Harmon talks about them: air, heat, food. And for ourselves, we rely on the mailman, the computers, our job, our mother and father, our partners, the sun to give light, our homes, our shelter, the weather. We depend on so many things. And it's really ignorant for us to think that we're a completely independent entity and that we don't rely on anything else. The nature of interdependence is that everything is dependent on everything else. So in this way, we have no control over certain things. If the air is taken from us, we die. If food is taken from us, we starve. If the sun goes out, there's no light, and not only we die, but the planet dies. So there's an element that we need to be humble and understand our true place in the cosmos and our reliance on all things. So in the next scene, we find that a message has come from the Oracle, and we head out to find her. Neo, Trinity, and Morpheus all head out to find her in the Nebuchadnezzar. And as they're leaving, Agent Smith, who's now inside Bane, sees Neo and basically immediately wants to kill him, but doesn't quite get the chance. So Neo enters the Matrix looking for the Oracle, but finds a new character called Seraph. And Neo knows that he's different because he can see it in the code. He's definitely different. And Seraph relates to the Seraphim, which are angels, a type of angel. And Seraph and Neo fight, and really we find out that Seraph is testing him at the moment. And he's testing him to make sure that he's fit for the Oracle, we could say. And just a personal note, I find this scene just a touch boring because we're used to so many different types of fighting in The Matrix, and we've seen the fighting, and not saying I was over it, but I think it would have been nicer if there was a different type of fighting, maybe an intellectual fighting or maybe kendo or something like that, just to raise the stakes a bit. So Neo passes the test, and we find that Seraph has keys that allow him to access any part of the Matrix through these back doors. So he also has a type of power, some keys that where he can enter any dimension, so to speak. So he takes Neo through one of these back doors to the Oracle. So Neo's happy about that.
Let's get the obvious stuff out of the way.
You're not human, are you?
Well, it's tough to get any more obvious than that.
If I had to guess, I'd say you're a program from the machine world. So is he.
So far, so good.
But if that's true, that could mean you are part of this system. Another kind of control.
Keep going.
I suppose the most obvious question is, how can I trust you?
Bingo.
So Neo asks the first question about trust, because he's going to ask advice from her, and he's asking if he should take that advice or not, because he's just found out that she's actually a program in the machine. So she's a program in the machine, and she's part of the machines, but she's going to give him advice to destroy the machines. So should you trust that? And it's very interesting that she answers it very swiftly and very clearly.
It is a pickle, no doubt about it. Bad news is there's no way if you can really know whether I'm here to help you or not. So it's really up to you. Just have to make up your own damn mind to either accept what I'm going to tell you or reject it. Tandy?
Do you already know if I'm going to take it?
Wouldn't be much of an oracle if I didn't.
But if you already know, how can I make a choice?
Because you didn't come here to make the choice. You've already made it. You're here to try to understand why you made it. I thought you'd have figured that out by now.
Pretty funny, the Oracle saying that at the end there. So the Oracle is interested in Neo finding his own way. Neo, the consciousness of Neo, has to find out for itself, and she leads him down that path. That there's trust here, there's trust there, you have to trust this person, you have to trust that person. But really, it's the consciousness that we need to find all these answers out for. And the path is just like that. There is never really any way of knowing until you've comprehended it, until you know it, until you've done it. When you walk the path, we make mistakes because the path itself is a process of learning. Someone who knows everything doesn't make mistakes. Someone who is learning makes mistakes. The most important aspect of mistakes is learning from them so you never do them again. And that's an aspect of the awakening. The dissolution of the ego is also like this. So the Oracle is telling Neo that he has to learn to make his own choices and also to comprehend them, that it's all on him, so to speak. So basically she says that Neo is going to have to find out for himself. And so she continues on.
Usually a program chooses exile when it faces deletion.
And why would a program be deleted?
Maybe it breaks down. Maybe a better program is created to replace it. Happens all the time. And when it does, a program can either choose to hide here or return to the source.
The machine mainframe?
Yes. Where you must go. Where the path of the one ends.
So the Oracle is now telling Neo what he must do. So she has once again given him purpose, that he must return to this thing called the source. So this is the same as finishing the path and entering what is known as the absolute, or as they say in the Kabbalah, the Ayin. So it's good that the Oracle gives Neo a purpose. He now has meaning in his life again. He now has something to do, the self-realization. And so I would say personally myself that the meaning of life is the spiritual path to self-realization. That nothing else matters in life, and it is why the cosmos exists in and of itself.
You have the sight now, Neo. You are looking at the world without time.
Then why can't I see what happens to her?
We can never see past the choices we don't understand.
Are you saying I have to choose whether Trinity lives or dies?
No. We've already made the choice. Now you have to understand it.
So the Oracle is continually explaining not just the nature of free choice, but what underlies free choice, the reason behind it, which is much, much, much more powerful. For example, let's look at a virtue that we would like to have. But the question is, why do we want it? So let's pick the virtue of serenity, to be serene and peaceful and tranquil. But why do we want to be serene? What is the reason? What is the underlying origin, we could say? So we can try to be serene and it doesn't last. Sometimes serenity naturally comes and we're happy. Say, for example, if we go camping or something like that. But it doesn't last. When we come back to the city, our serenity disappears. So we know that people have moments of serenity and peace. Children can be serene, a dog can be serene, but they both don't know why they're serene. They don't know how. It doesn't know why serenity is broken, that serenity is just momentary, that we might have serenity for some minutes or a period of time, but then it leaves us. So when we have a true and deep knowledge of a virtue, say of serenity, when we deeply comprehend the true nature of serenity itself, it means that we're able to maintain it. It comes to live within us eternally. So we wish for virtues, love, compassion, forgiveness, sacrifice to be with us always. And this is the nature of the path.
And that there is a very important teaching and message that the Oracle is trying to teach Neo. Now, unfortunately, that's all we have time for this part. And thank you, Christian. We look forward to you coming back next week and explaining the rest of Matrix Reloaded to us.
Happy to come back.
Excellent. We see you then, and hope our listeners can tune in next week, Tuesday, 6:30 p.m. Adelaide time, or listen to the podcast on the website, gnosticwaves.com. And have a good evening.